Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into the material you sent us, all about protecting your landscape. And we're starting with what is, I think, the most overlooked step in pest control.
It absolutely is. I mean, when you look at why management efforts fail, it almost always comes down to two things.
Okay.
First, just straight up misidentification of the pest. Or second, you get the ID right, but you have no idea about its life cycle.
Right. People just jump straight to the solution without really knowing what the problem is.
Exactly. And that solution, without a clear target, is often useless or worse, actually harmful.
So that's what we're going to fix. We're going to stop reacting and start, you know, observing. We're breaking down the four big categories: weeds, invertebrates, vertebrates, and plant pathogens.
And maybe most importantly, we're going to separate the real pests from the fake pests, the things that look like a disease but are actually just an environmental issue.
Biotic versus abiotic. A living thing versus, say, just bad weather.
That's the core distinction we need to make.
All right, so let's unpack that foundational step. The sources are so clear on this. Before anything else, you have to know your host. Why is it so critical to know that you're looking at, for example, a Vinca major plant?
Well, think about it. Every plant has its own set of common problems, its own weaknesses.
Okay.
If you don't know you have Vinca, you can't look up its typical enemies. You might see a fungus and think it's an insect, or you might apply a chemical that particular plant is really sensitive to. Knowing the host plant just narrows the field of suspects immediately.
Which is pretty essential when the suspects themselves are microscopic.
Yes, exactly. The scale is a huge problem. You're not going to spot a nematode with your naked eye. You just won't.
So you need tools.
You need tools. A hand lens, maybe a microscope, special tests. And since you often can't see the culprit directly, you have to become a detective. You have to learn to read the signs they leave behind.
Okay, this is the really cool part. The characteristic signs. What kind of clues are we talking about?
Well, for bigger things, it's obvious. Birds and rodents leave nests or burrows. But for smaller things, you look for patterns. Mites, for example, leave this incredibly fine, delicate webbing, usually on the underside of a leaf.
And what about their waste, the frass?
Frass is a huge clue. That's the technical term for, you know, insect droppings. The size and shape of that frass can sometimes tell you the exact species you're dealing with.
So it's like a fingerprint.
It is. Just like a snail's slime trail is unmistakable, it's all evidence.
But what if the signs are confusing? What if it's something internal, like a pathogen?
Then you need to call in the experts, your local cooperative extension or, you know, state-run labs. But if you're sending them a sample, it has to be a good one.
A dead, dried-up leaf isn't going to cut it.
It's useless. They need fresh material, especially the transition zone between the roots and the stem. And you have to provide context, the type of plant, where you found it, when you collected it. You're basically giving them a piece of the crime scene.
Okay, so with those fundamentals down, let's get to the first group of enemies, the green competitors, weeds.
And it's funny, a weed is only a weed because we don't want it there, right? It's just a plant in the wrong place.
A very successful plant in the wrong place.
Oh, they are masters of survival. They compete for everything, water, nutrients, light, and they can be a real safety hazard too on something like a sports field.
Their survival abilities are just, they're incredible.
They are. First, they adapt perfectly to the local soil and climate, but their main weapon is just sheer numbers. They produce an astronomical amount of seeds.
And those seeds can just wait.
For 20 years or more, they can lie dormant in the soil just waiting for the right conditions. They're like these little ticking time bombs.
And they're not just waiting for the wind to blow them around either.
No, not at all. You have things like Curly Dock with these little bladder-like floats so they can travel on water. Or, you know, Burklover and Foxtail that are designed to just latch onto your clothes or an animal's fur.
But the real kicker is how they reproduce underground.
Yes. This is where so many control efforts fail. I'm talking about things like stolons, rhizomes, tubers.
So if you have something like nutsedge and you go out there with a hoe,
you're in big trouble. You think you're killing it, but you're just chopping that underground rhizome into, say, 20 pieces.
And each piece becomes a new plant.
Each piece becomes a new identical plant. You've just done the weeds work for it. You've propagated it. That's why perennials are so tough.
That makes perfect sense. So to control them, you need to know what you're dealing with. Let's do the quick taxonomy breakdown. Dicots and monocots.
Right. Dicots, or broad leaves, are pretty easy to spot. They come up with two little seedling leaves, the cotyledons, and their true leaves have veins that look like a net.
And that group includes some really strange ones, like parasitic plants.
Things like dodder and mistletoe, which steal nutrients directly from a host plant.
And monocots are basically the grasses.
Your grasses, sedges, rushes, they pop up with a single grass-like leaf, and their veins are all parallel. And you also have groups like mosses and algae.
Which aren't really weeds in the same way. They're more like an indicator.
Exactly. If you see moss, it doesn't mean you need a moss killer. It means your soil is probably too wet or too shady. You have to fix the environment, not just kill the plant.
And this all ties back to the life cycle, right?
Yeah.
Annual, biennial, perennial.
It's everything. If it's an annual, it lives for 1 year. Your only job is to stop it from producing seed.
Get it before it flowers.
Yes. If it's a biennial, you have 2 years. It grows leaves in year one, flowers in year two. So you have to get it in year one. But the perennials,
they're the ones with the underground parts.
They live forever. They come back every year from those roots and rhizomes. Killing the top growth does almost nothing. You have to destroy that underground system. That's a completely different strategy.
Okay, that sets us up for the things that move. The invertebrates. We're talking arthropods, insects, spiders, mites. And I think the default reaction is if it crawls, kill it.
And that's the biggest misconception we have to get past. It's fascinating, but only about 3% of all arthropod species are actually considered pests.
Only 3%.
That's it. The huge majority are either neutral or beneficial, like spiders. Spiders are your allies. If you just spray indiscriminately, you're wiping out your own pest control team.
So identification here is about protecting the good guys.
Yeah.
And it starts with body parts, right? Counting the segments.
Absolutely. Insects have 3 body parts: a head, a thorax, and an abdomen. 6 legs. Spiders have 2 parts, the cephalothorax and the abdomen, and 8 legs.
And then there are mites, which people always confuse with insects.
But they're structurally very different. 2 main body segments, and the adults have 8 legs, but the immatures might have fewer. And knowing that is crucial because a standard insecticide won't work on a mite. They have totally different biologies.
And their damage looks different too, right? You mentioned stippling.
Yes, it's like tiny little pinpricks all over the leaf that causes this bleaching or bronze effect. Very characteristic.
So body parts tell you what to spray, but the life cycle tells you when. Let's talk about complete versus gradual metamorphosis.
Sure. Complete metamorphosis is that classic 4-stage transformation. You have the egg, then the larva, which is usually a worm-like caterpillar.
The main eating stage.
The main eating and damage stage. Then you have the pupa, which is the resting stage, and then the adult. Think of butterfly. The larva and the adult are completely different creatures.
So you have to target that destructive larva stage.
Usually, yes. Now, gradual metamorphosis is much simpler. The egg hatches and out comes a nymph, which basically looks like a tiny wingless version of the adult.
Like a grasshopper.
Like a grasshopper or an aphid. It just molts and gets bigger until it's an adult. So with those pests, you can generally target any life stage.
Let's talk about a few of those key orders and this pest or beneficial paradox. Homopterans, aphids, white flies.
They're almost all problematic. They have these piercing, sucking mouth parts, so they're literally sucking the life out of the plant. But the real issue is what they excrete.
The honeydew.
Right. This sticky, sugary waste that drips everywhere. And then a black, sooty mold starts to grow on it, which looks awful and blocks sunlight. Plus, they are major vectors for plant viruses.
Okay, now for the paradox. Hymenoptera. Bees, wasps, and ants. Bees and wasps are mostly good guys.
Incredibly important. Pollinators, predators, parasites of other pests. But ants. Ants can be a huge problem, especially Argentine ants.
Because they protect the aphids.
They literally farm them. The ants harvest the honeydew from the aphids, and in return, they act like bodyguards, fighting off beneficial insects like parasitic wasps that would normally keep the aphid population in check.
So if you have an ant problem on a plant, you need to look closer for...
For an aphid or scale insect problem, the ants are just a symptom.
Okay, but let's touch on the really weird ones. Nematodes, microscopic worms.
Yep, most are harmless, but the plant parasitic ones are nasty. They inject stuff into the roots that causes them to swell up into these galls or knots.
So you won't see the damage directly?
No, you just see the plant suffering. It looks yellow, stunted. Like it needs water or fertilizer, but the real problem is that its root system has been hijacked.
And then finally, the ones we can see pretty clearly, slugs and snails.
Easy to identify. Slugs have no shell, snails have one, and they both leave those classic glistening slime trails. They can wipe out a bed of seedlings in one night.
But even here, there's a beneficial one, the decollete snail.
Right, which eats other pest snails. But its introduction is restricted in some places to protect native snails. which just proves, again, how complex this whole pest versus beneficial calculation really is.
Okay, let's shift to the last two big groups. First, the vertebrates. Animals with backbones, mammals, birds, reptiles. Here, identification is not just about control, it's about the law.
It is, absolutely. So many of these species are protected. You can't just decide to get rid of a squirrel or a certain type of bird. You have to know exactly what species you're dealing with and what the regulations are.
And their damage is pretty distinct.
Very. A rabbit leaves a clean 45-degree angle cut on a twig. A gopher leaves a messy chew mark. Their burrows and mounds are also a dead giveaway and can be serious safety hazards.
And we can't forget disease.
No. Rodents can carry fleas that transmit plague. Bats can transmit rabies. So this is also a public health issue.
Okay, let's go from the biggest to the smallest. The true pathogens. These are the living things that can actually spread from plant to plant.
The three big ones are fungi, bacteria, and viruses. Fungi are primitive organisms that reproduce with spores. And the key thing to know is that those spores are spread by wind, splashing water.
And us.
And us. On our tools, on our hands. They cause the things we recognize, like powdery mildews and rusts and rots.
How does that differ from what bacteria do?
Bacteria are single-celled and need warm, wet conditions. They often get in through a wound. Their damage tends to look wet. Water-soaked spots, slimy ooze, that kind of thing. Fungal spots often look more dry or powdery.
And viruses are the sneakiest of all.
They're submicroscopic. They get inside the plant cells and hijack them. You don't see the virus. You just see the bizarre symptoms, weird mosaic color patterns on the leaves, distorted growth. And they almost always need a helper to get around.
An insect vector.
An aphid or a whitefly. It bites an infected plant, picks up the virus, and then injects it into the next plant it feeds on.
All right, this brings us to what might be the most important topic of all, the great misdiagnosis, the imposters, abiotic disorders.
This is the so what moment, because abiotic disorders are caused by non-living environmental factors, weather, water, nutrients.
And the most important part is
they cannot be transmitted from one plant to another.
So if one of my plants has scorched leaves because of a sudden frost, spraying it with a fungicide is completely pointless.
It's worse than pointless. You're wasting time and money, and sometimes the chemical itself can cause more damage, pesticide injury, which is another abiotic disorder. You're just piling one problem on top of another.
What are the top abiotic imposters we need to look out for?
I'd say number one is temperature. Cool soil can make a plant show nutrient deficiency symptoms even when the nutrients are there. The roots just can't absorb them.
Okay, what's number two?
Water. Too much or too little. Both can cause wilting, yellowing, and leaf drop that looks exactly like a fungal root rot disease. But the fix is just changing your watering schedule.
And a third one.
Just physical stress, windburn, soil that's so compacted the roots can't breathe, or a plant that's been in a pot for too long and is completely root bound. These are all cultural problems, not disease problems. You have to change the conditions, not reach for a spray bottle.
This whole deep dive really changes your perspective, doesn't it? It moves you from just looking at a problem to actually diagnosing it.
Right. It's all about understanding the mechanism. Is this a perennial weed that will just laugh at your hoe because its power is in the roots? Or is it an insect with complete metamorphosis where you have a really narrow window to hit that larval stage?
And most of all, is it even a living thing? Is it biotic? Something that can spread and needs to be controlled? Or is it abiotic, an issue that just requires a change in how you're caring for the plant?
That knowledge of body structure, life cycle, and context, that is the shortcut to success.
I think what we're left with is this idea that not everything we see as damage is necessarily a threat that needs to be eliminated. Sometimes the right choice is to just leave it alone.
Precisely. We have to remember that a landscape is an ecosystem. You know, if you want to have butterflies, you have to be willing to tolerate some caterpillars chewing on your leaves. That's the trade-off. Or if you see those Argentine ants, maybe your first target isn't the ant, but the aphid colony, it's farming. Ultimately, every decision to manage a pest is a cost-benefit analysis. And that final decision, well, that's something only you, the informed observer, can make.